We move to the second case today, United States v. Siebel.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rick Duffin, and I represent the defendant appellant Philip Michael Siebelt. This is a criminal case in which the defendant was convicted by a jury and sentenced to 30 years imprisonment. The indictment on which the defendant was charged and on which he was prosecuted contains four very specific counts, and I'd like to lay those out briefly because I think they're important to the rest of my argument here. The first count is that he possessed child pornography that had been shipped through interstate commerce. Second count is that he transported a very specific image of child pornography through interstate commerce by using the internet over his computer. The third count is that he transported a second very specific image also through interstate commerce by using his computer and the internet. And the fourth count is that he published a notice or advertisement on the internet offering to receive or exchange basically pictures of child pornography. If any one of us had sat through the trial in this case as a member of the jury, we may not have known that that's all the defendant was charged with. We very likely would have thought the defendant was charged with many additional crimes beyond those four very specific counts. And that's because of the testimony and the evidence that was presented by the prosecution, the other crimes evidence that was presented by the prosecution that falls well outside of what the specific counts were.
At what point was that testimony offered?
From the very beginning in the prosecution's opening statement, the prosecution informed the jury that the defendant had allegedly molested his male cousin, his relative. So this started from the very beginning. It continued through the course of the trial. During the trial, on no less than six occasions that I counted in the transcript, the prosecution elicited testimony that the defendant had allegedly molested his male relative.
Is there any objection with regard to the opening statement comment?
I don't believe so. There was quite a lack of objections on the defense part throughout the trial. There was a motion in limine to exclude any evidence of the alleged molestation that was denied by the court. In addition to the male cousin, there was testimony that the defendant had allegedly driven to Wisconsin to molest a 16-year-old girl, that he kept a pair of child's Pokemon underwear under his bed, and that he had allegedly molested children in the park. This evidence is particularly damaging in this case because there was no limiting instruction given to the jury prior to the start of the case, during the opening statements, during the case in chief, during the closing arguments. Limiting instruction came at the very end in jury instructions, but the jury sat here for 3 days listening to repeated testimony and repeated argument about how the defendant had allegedly committed all of these other crimes without knowing really that the defendant wasn't even charged with these crimes. The jury may have thought that the defendant was being charged with these crimes.
Well, I assume the jury was told at the beginning of the trial what the charges were.
I assume they were as well, and I'm sure that they were, but there's repeated reference to all of these other bad acts. It's almost as if the trial had been taken over by these other bad acts in this case. None of the evidence should have been admitted under 404B. 404B, of course, says that evidence of propensity of evidence of other crimes can't be admitted to show conformity with a particular character or to show propensity evidence, essentially. And 404B has a four-part test. The evidence must prove something other than propensity. The other acts must be similar and close enough in time. The evidence must be clear and convincing. And the probative value must not be substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. The first part of that I'd like to discuss is the similarity. There really is no similarity between the other crimes evidence and the four very specific counts of which the defendant was charged in this case. In terms of the male cousin that the defendant had allegedly molested, there are no similarities there. The prosecution told the jury and elicited testimony that the defendant had molested his male cousin over the years at the family home on holidays. Now, these are specific acts of molestation. Defendant's not charged with any acts of molestation. He's not charged with molesting anyone. He's charged with essentially having photographs of child pornography and transmitting these.
Well,
over,
the fourth count
over
about
the
advertisement. The advertisement count. He was looking for kids to molest. So,
he was. That's true in terms of the fourth count. But again, there's no count that he molested anyone. There's no charge that he that in terms of count four. There's no evidence that he offered to show pictures of his male relative cousin.
But all of the other acts evidence establishes a motive for all of the charged offenses, which is sexual interest in children.
Well, there is, I understand, and I don't disagree that there is a, this evidence does show that there is a sexual interest in children. But I think we need to take each of them in turn and ask the question, does molesting the male cousin show a motive for possessing child pornography? And I don't believe it does. Does molesting the male cousin show a motive for advertising
Judge
on the internet?
Though it does, that was a specific... His advertisement was, how can I better position myself to molest children?
That's true, and it does show a sexual interest in children, of course, and I don't disagree with that. But I think, you know, it's not that similar. It doesn't show that much of a motive, the specific acts. And even if it does, we need to go down to the fourth part of 404B, which is that the evidence needs the probative value needs to must not substantially be outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And if I could, and this is something that I cited in my brief, the Third Circuit has held as follows. We accept without extensive argument that implications of child molestation, homosexuality, and abusive women are unfairly prejudicial to a defendant. Indeed, no evidence could be more inflammatory or more prejudicial than allegations of child molestation.
Was that a child pornography case?
I believe it. I don't recall exactly what the case was, Your Honor. It did involve child pornography. I don't believe it involved, you know, the abusive women part that the court mentioned. But I do believe it did involve child pornography and child molestation. But the point is that this evidence is overwhelmingly prejudicial to any defendant. I don't believe that it's similar enough, and it is. Overly prejudicial. It's particularly over prejudicial when you don't have a limiting instruction, when the, you know, until the very end of the case, when the jury sits here for 3 days and listens to all of this evidence, and then in closing arguments, the prosecution refers to the defendant as a child molester and states, quote unquote, that he repeatedly molested his young relative. That evidence is, of course, damaging and is prejudicial, and it needs to be considered in terms of what the probative value is. Now, in terms of motive, the district court did not admit this evidence because of the value of motive. The prosecution argued to the district court that the evidence of other crimes, and specifically the male cousin being molested, should be admitted to show identity of the defendant as the person who used the screen name on the internet that's at issue here, and also to show reliability of the confession. And the probative value of those 2 points is very, very low. In terms of identity, there really was no question that the defendant was the person who used this particular screen name. He admitted it, allegedly admitted it in a confession. When the FBI conducted their search of the defendant's home, they knew and they discovered as well that the defendant lived there with his mother. They were the only 2 people who lived in the house. Computer equipment, the images of child pornography, were not recovered from anywhere in the house except from in the defendant's bedroom.
That raises a point. Isn't this evidence so overwhelming that the fact that this, even if we find it was improper to admit it, wouldn't make any difference?
Well, there is significant evidence against the defendant. I don't disagree with that. I do believe that the improperly admitted evidence here really precluded the jury from doing anything but finding the defendant guilty here. This is particularly so with count 3, and this was a point that was raised in our brief. In count 3, the defendant is charged with transporting a specific image titled HEL-AN09 to an individual by the name of Gustav Premier. There was no testimony from Gustav Premier that he received this image. There was no review of Gustav Premier's hard drive to see if he actually received this image.
Is receipt an element of the offense?
It needs to actually be transported, and
does
there's no evidence.
Does it have to be received?
I don't know that it needs to be received. It needs to, for example, if it went through the internet and went through, wherever the internet was located, I believe it was out of state. If it went to that point, sure, that would be sufficient. It wouldn't need to actually be received by Gustav Premier. But I think it's important that there was no evidence by Gustav Premier, because there's a total lack of evidence on this. The only evidence that we have is from Officer Zagliffa, who testified that the defendant's computer had logged a message from Gustav Premier saying, you know, please give me this particular image, and then a response from the defendant's computer saying it's on its way. But there's no expert opinion. The prosecution tried to present expert testimony from the police officer. The district court judge denied that, held that he was not an expert in computers, or at least there wasn't sufficient testimony to show that he was an expert in computers. And we really don't know what the message "it's on its way" means. It seems simple enough. It's on its way. You would think means the image is on its way and that it's being sent. But there's another example later on in the testimony of FBI agent Mark Miller, in which Mark Miller testifies that he requested an image from the defendant's computer. The message from defendant's computer stated it's on its way, and that he never actually received the message.
Well, now, that gets back to my question. Receipt is not an element of the offense, so that's a red herring. And Officer Miller, or Agent Miller, explained why he didn't receive it. It was because he lost his internet connection.
Well, what officer...
And so the jury can infer, based on the totality of the testimony from the agents, whether they were qualified as experts or not, that's irrelevant here. The jury could infer that the message, "it's on its way," means that there has been a transmission, and that's all you need.
I would disagree with that. I would say that we need somebody who actually understands the computer program, who knows the inner workings of the program, and who can tell us exactly when a message says it's on its way doesn't mean that the message is sent.
Why is that necessary? Is there any legal authority for that proposition, that you need an expert in computers?
The district court certainly thought that you would need somebody.
I'm talking about legal authority.
To do that.
Any opinions on the subject other than the trial court?
No, there's no opinions that I've found, but I think it's important to keep in mind that this is a computer program, that there was no testimony as to how exactly the computer program works in terms of, you know, how does this police officer know that it works and that it works this way. In terms of the internet connection being lost, well, the question is, how long does it take for the image to be transmitted? There was no testimony on that. Is the image, I would imagine, you know, based on my limited experience with computers, that if something says it's on its way to me, computer connections are so quick that it would be there in under a minute. If I send an email message, I can send anyone an email message, and they basically instantly receive it. It doesn't take a full minute to do that.
Not in the court system.
When we're talking about sophisticated computer equipment that we had involved here, and the sophisticated computer equipment of the FBI, I would imagine that a transmission takes place very quickly. The point is that we don't know. Was it received? I agree. That's not an element of it. And what I'm really talking about, was it actually even transmitted? We don't know that. There is a lack of evidence there.
From the testimony of the agents who initiated the investigation, that every time they established a link with your client's computer and requested the file sharing, that they got it. With this one exception, which you're arguing creates a reasonable doubt, which is an argument to make to a jury, but not to an appellate court.
Well, I believe the argument is that there's insufficient evidence. And that would, of course, be a proper argument here, that there was insufficient evidence to show beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty on count three. And I believe that leads back to the earlier question, which was, is the evidence so overwhelming here? And I don't think that it's overwhelming when you take into consideration that there is reasonable doubt on count three. Another point that I'd like to raise briefly, and I think this is very important as well, is there was testimony from a London police officer, and let me back up for one second. The images that were at issue in count two and in count three were allegedly taken in London by an individual who had molested his children and posted these advertisements or these photographs on the internet. That individual was investigated by the London police officer who testified at Philip Siebel's trial, and the officer testified that she investigated the individual who had taken those photographs, which is perfectly fine because I believe that the government wanted to show, and it's proper to show, that the images, and these are the same images that the defendant in this case possessed, that the images were of children and that they were of children under the age of 18 years old. And I don't have any disagreement or any argument with that. What I find particularly troubling here is that this London police officer was then allowed to go on and testify that the individual who took these photographs in London was convicted by a court in London of having these, possessing these photographs. And I believe that a jury listening to this evidence very easily could have said to itself, if a court of law found the London person guilty over here for possessing these, then certainly the defendant must be guilty as well because he's charged with possessing those photographs. And I think that is particularly damaging testimony here.
Mr. Duffin, your time has expired.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Perry?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The record in this case simply does not bear out appellant's assertions that the prior bad acts evidence overwhelmed the trial in any way. The majority of the prior bad acts evidence that appellant refers to was admitted as part of the defendant's confession in this case. It was not as though the government brought in extraneous witnesses to talk about...
Well, what about the underwear under the bed? What's that got to do with anything?
Well, two things. First, that was part of the defendant's confession in this case.
What's it got to do with any of the charges?
Specifically, it's direct evidence of the defendant's knowledge of the items that were under his bed, some of which were child pornography, which he was charged with possessing. And to the extent that he admitted knowing about and using the underwear that was under the bed right next to that child pornography, that's direct evidence of the crime of possession in this case. Additionally...
It's not very good.
Perhaps not, but that's a decision for the jury to make in this case. And although appellant's counsel says today that there was no issue of identity, that these items were in the defendant's room, and that was all admitted...
If you were trying this case again, would you ask that evidence be admitted?
Well, Judge, I was not the trial attorney in the...
All right, if you were for the first time trying the case, would you ask it to go in?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. We could have made the case without it. I think the evidence is overwhelming without it, and that, of course, goes to the harmless error or prejudice part of the analysis.
Probably would.
I can't speak to that, Judge.
All right.
I do think it is important evidence, though, to the extent the defense counsel said at the pretrial conference that they would be challenging identity, and specifically the judge asked, are you going to admit the issue of identity?
They said they'd be at the pretrial conference, they challenged the identity?
Yes. Defense counsel said, I'm not going to admit that. The court followed up and said, are you going to attack the confession as being unreliable, either that it's not in his own words or that it's not what he said? And defense counsel said, yes. We will cross-examine on the reliability and the details of the confession. So to the extent that on the April 1st, 2003 pretrial conference...
I accept that. Did they challenge it, though, during the course of the trial?
Reviewing the record, it's a little difficult to see what exactly was being challenged, what was not. You couldn't tell from the opening statement which way the defense was going to be heading. It was a very brief opening statement. By the closing arguments, though, the defense was saying that basically his computer was doing these things on its own, that who knows how these computers work, but he wasn't there distributing these images. And to that extent, there was at least a small way a challenge to how could he have been in charge of this? Was he the one directing it? And, Your Honors, as a government attorney, in a pretrial instance, you asked me to think about how I would have presented this case had I been doing it. I'd like you to think just about the average juror and how unfathomable it is to the average juror that anyone could possess these types of things. And Philip Siebel was a young man, and he lived with his mother. And you look at this man, and the average juror thinks, how could he possibly do this? Why would he possibly do this? And that's why the motive becomes so important in this case. And the motive, especially with the male cousin, was, as he said in his online chats, which the appellant is also challenging the admission of, specifically says, I molested my male cousin. He's too old now. I need to find someone new to molest. And that right there, in his own words, is his motive for posting that advertisement in which he said, I need tips, tactics, and advice on how to molest children. Can anyone provide me with those? If you do, I'll produce child pornography for you. That right there is great evidence of the defendant's motive, the defendant's identity, all of which are proper purposes under Rule 404B. Apart from that, I believe the government's position is stated in its briefs. If the court has no additional questions, we would ask that you affirm the conviction on count 3, that you also affirm the convictions on counts 1 and 4, and that the case be remanded for a Paladino remand with regard to sentencing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.